It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you remember the first time you felt the call of the road?
I was at Colby College, which is one of these Ivy-covered liberal arts schools.
Long-haul trucker Finn Murphy.
My parents and I were walking down this leafy walkway. Somebody's playing guitar under a tree, and there's a couple kids throwing frisbee, and I said, I'm not coming back here. I'm going to sign up with North American Van Lines, and I'm going to become a driver. My father, who had never gone to college, and that was the one thing he didn't accomplish in his life, he said, you've done 3 years here, just one more year. Why don't you just come back and finish? And I said, because I'm afraid it's going to finish me off first. When we got home, he actually gave me a bill for 3 years' tuition, which he expected me to pay back. I looked at it, and I was shocked. I couldn't believe that he was doing this. And I flung it back at him, and I cursed at him. And he looked at me, and he said, don't use that language in my house. And I said, I'm not going to use anything in your house. And I picked up my duffel bag, walked out of the house, and went down the street to where my truck was parked. It was to be my first day as a truck driver. And my parents and I didn't speak for 2 years.
Everybody loves the road, but some people love it more than others. Finn Murphy found his career and his calling on America's highways. He's the author of The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. And the first thing he told Steve Paulson is that he's not just any driver with a big rig. He's a long-haul mover, or as truckers say, a bedbugger.
We've got bedbuggers, those are the movers. You've got the live animal haulers, those are the chicken chokers. You've got the flatbedders, those are the skateboarders. You've got the hazardous material people, those are the suicide jockeys. Yeah, so everybody's got a nickname.
And when you say you move people or you move families, I mean, what you're saying is you load all of their stuff. You load their lives into the back of your truck.
Yes, and we pack their lives. I mean, the moves I do now, people don't lift a finger. A more or less typical example, I had one few months ago. A man was moving to Vancouver from Connecticut. We walked in, my crew of seven movers and myself. He finished his coffee. He loaded his family into the limousine. They took off for the airport, and we washed the dishes, stripped the beds, packed every single carton, loaded the truck, put his car in the truck. And then at the other end, we unpacked everything, put his dishes back in the brake front, made his beds. This is full service move. These things cost, $70,000, $80,000.
I'll say full service. My God, you even washed the dishes.
Sure, why not?
What about life on the road? Do you like that?
Well, it's more comfortable now than it used to be. The trucks are better. I've got a nice brand new sleeper in the back. I've got a Sealy Posturepedic mattress. I've got 600 count sheets in the sleeper. I've got a feather duvet, and I've got a microwave oven, a refrigerator, a desk. It's actually very nice.
You do not sleep in motels, in other words. I mean, you sleep in your truck.
Most of the time. If I sleep in a motel if I have to spend a few days or something like that, but there's no reason to. My truck is cleaner than most motels, and it's certainly cheaper. And my minibar has Gatorade in it, and it's not $8. So, yes, I sleep in the truck.
So I'm curious about what life on the road looks like from the trucker's perspective. I mean, any of us who have driven cars on a highway, with their trucks whizzing by us. And I guess I'm wondering, is there anything we should know about what you do or about, what trucks are like, as we're driving by? I mean, what don't we see in your life or in your rig?
Well, let's start with what we do see, because we see everything that people do in their cars.
You're checking us out.
Absolutely everything. Yeah. So if you've driven by a truck driving a car and you've been in the passenger seat, have you noticed you look up at the truck, at the driver, right, and then he looks back at you? So that happens every time. It's some kind of telepathy thing. I don't know how that happens, but I know when somebody's looking at me.
And do you like that? I mean, is that meaningful at all, that moment of eye contact?
It can be. It depends on what people are doing. Sometimes you have the kids doing the arm thing, mm-hmm, so that you hit the air horn. Sometimes you just have somebody look up and then you get this, you can see they're sort of wistfully looking over and wondering, like your question is, well, you know, what kind of life is that up there with that guy? So that's nice. I guess what I was saying about we can see everything what people do in their cars is most people are usually doing something else in addition to driving. You want to know what the main events are that people do in their cars? People are eating. People are spilling liquids.
Really? It happens that often?
Oh, yeah. It's not just you, Steve. No, they're disciplining the kids in the backseat. They're texting and putting on makeup. But here's the number one activity for American drivers is they are working on their relationship with the person in the passenger seat. And you can tell that from the body language, from the index fingers, from the shrugs. There's a lot of romances being worked out here. Mostly it looks like there's some conflict. Every once in a while you get to see a romantic moment that's not in conflict, which is very pleasant but also very rare.
It sounds like you are kind of writing the novel in your mind, you know, what's going on in that car as you drive by?
Yeah, that's correct. I am. And I'm also writing the novel when I'm going through communities and towns and start thinking about what's changed in terms of community character, what's changed in terms of what's going on in America.
Does the country look different now? Has America changed?
So there is the denuding or the hollowing out of downtowns all over the country. You might think that it's just happened to your town or Joe Smith might think it only happened to his town, but this has happened in, you know, 15,000 towns around the United States. The core districts are denuded of locally owned stores, and then all the new commercial development is in the big boxes on the outskirts. I don't think that's good for community character. I don't think that's good for sense of place. I don't think it's good for middle-class jobs that were there that are no longer there. That's one big change that I've seen for sure. And then another big change is how the heartland, the Midwest, from St. Louis to San Bernardino. I mean, there's nothing in the middle of the country anymore. It's a corn monoculture and there's no towns at all.
And I mean, that was not the case when you were first driving?
No. So this was in 1980. It had begun. Mm-hmm. But no, that wasn't the case. There was all sorts of, you know, vibrant towns along U.S. Route 6 goes from Cape Cod to San Francisco. U.S. Route 50 goes through Kansas, Garden City, Kansas, places like that. You know, these used to be very vibrant small communities, and there was one after another, after another, after another, and it's all gone. I don't know where it went. I don't know how it went that way, but it's done.
Hmm. So is this a beautiful country to you or not? I mean, from what you're saying, maybe it's less beautiful than it used to be.
Well, it depends on the day, Steve. So I do have a passage in there where I got really sort of dark and cynical. I think I said something to the effect of, if you wanted to do a tourist poster of the United States, instead of doing a Vermont church with a white spire, why don't we do the real thing, which is a convenience store with a Subway franchise inside and an underpaid immigrant mopping the floor, and outside somebody's holding a piece of cardboard saying anything helps. That's true. And it's not all the truth, the entire truth, but that is part of the truth. And yes, is it beautiful? In many, many, many places it is. As I said, you know, I think the New Jersey Turnpike is beautiful. I also think the Rocky Mountains are beautiful. I don't think replacing every truck stop restaurant with a Subway franchise is particularly beautiful.
You also say that there are moments that are just total adrenaline rushes, like driving into New York City. You have a great passage in your book where you describe what this is like going into New York City. Could you read that?
I would love to read that. So here we go.
Okay.
Coming into Metro New York from points west or south has always supercharged me, but doing it in a big truck is pure adrenaline. This is the closest I've ever come to feeling the true essence of life on the road. I've got a hard, muscled body, a big, comfortable new tractor hauling a 53-foot moving trailer, grooving with my killer sound system, a 30-ounce Dr. Cola in the holder. Then there's the whistle of the supercharger as I shift into 13th gear, the whoosh of the air dryer, my mouth slightly sour, arms shaking from the pounding of the wheel, making money, setting my own schedule, the Manhattan skyline on my right, flying fast and furious on my way up to home plate in Connecticut. Me and the monster truck are hurtling through 16 lanes of the most intense, dangerous, and exhilarating piece of roadway ever devised by man. And I'm the king of it all, with my truck, my tunes, and my big independence. All the stories, the longings, the dreams, the books, the movies, the songs, the great American dream of chucking it all and hitting the road. Well, right at this moment, I am the song.
That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Kerouac in a truck.
But I have more focus. I'm actually going somewhere. Yes, and I'm actually paying my own bills.
Finn Murphy's book is called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. He was talking with Steve Paulson. We're talking about road trips this hour. And I confess, I don't especially love or even much like driving. I do take it for granted that I can. But imagine living in a country where women aren't allowed to drive.
It was Thursday. There was blue sky. We were in the parking lot where I took the driver's seat. When I turned the engine on, I had this rush of adrenaline, and I felt like a bird coming out of a cage. I had sweaty hands. And I fixed, like, my hijab, because I was thinking if the religious police stop me, I have to look as decent as I could. It was the first time I drove it in the city, but women cannot drive. It was really liberating, just a simple act of starting your car and driving. That day I said, let's just drive and pass by the landmarks in the city. Make sure that when we videotape, we take shots of the street's name just to make a statement that women can go behind the wheel and drive. We posted that video on YouTube that night. The next day it was trending worldwide. I wanted to get arrested. So I asked my brother, can I drive again? This time your car, and I want to pass by a police car. We passed by a police car. I was pulled over. Someone called the religious police. That's when things went really nasty.
Manal al-Sharif on the drive that changed her life. We'll find out how after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. I grew up assuming that as a woman in America, I can do pretty much anything a man does. Get an education, a job, own a house, drive a car. But Manal al-Sharif grew up in Saudi Arabia, where women have to fight for those privileges. And she did. She got a degree in computer science. She became one of the first women to work in IT at Aramco, the national oil company. And then, on her 32nd birthday, she did something that would seem so harmless here. She drove a car in public, which turned her into the leading voice of the Women to Drive movement and also put her life at risk. In a memoir called Daring to Drive, Manal tells the story of how she was imprisoned and charged with driving while female.
What I violated was not a law, was a custom. And even if there was a law, I would challenge that law because it's unjust. The same night after I was released at 2 a.m., the secret police showed up at my doorstep. I was taken for interrogation and then I was strip searched. And they put me in jail, woman jail.
And how long did you stay there?
I was there for 9 days.
When you were arrested, what was the public reaction?
The newspaper didn't do me well, really. They pictured me as evil, as Asian to the West, as someone who wants to corrupt the women, as unholy. One clerk went so far to call for my lashing in public.
Hmm. Manal, I think it's important for women here to understand just how physically restricted life is for women in Saudi Arabia, how much less freedom they have just to move about, to go places, even, for instance, to leave the house.
Imagine you live in a city, big city like Los Angeles, and you don't have a car. You don't have public transportation, and you don't have taxi companies that are reliable. And at the same time, you cannot walk in the city. Now you need to go to a job or your school or just simple act of going and buying your grocery. These are our cities. So we're forced to hire men to drive our own cars, and they live with us in our homes. So we have to bring non-Saudis to drive our cars. They don't speak our language. They don't even know how to drive a car. We have to teach them.
So women can own cars, but they just can't drive them?
Yes. My car is under my name. I bought my car. I paid for it, but I couldn't drive it. And I had a driver's license from New Hampshire.
This shadow transportation system you described, what I don't understand is you said this is a system of mostly foreign taxi drivers who in many cases are illiterate or don't know the rules of the road. And these are the men that women hire to drive them places. And yet, most of the time in every other aspect of life, women are never allowed to be alone with men in Saudi Arabia, strange men, except in this one instance.
This is the contradiction. We have the gender apartheid in my country, where men and women are never allowed to mix. So growing up, men and women, we studied in different schools, different colleges. My male professors, I've never met them. I've always seen them through CCTV. The families themselves are segregated, where my cousins, my own cousins, when I reach puberty, I cannot talk to them. I cannot mix with them.
You can't talk to your male relatives?
No. If I meet them today in the street, I wouldn't even recognize my cousins. But the right to drive in my country is, we use it as a symbol of civil disobedience to protest the guardianship system, that the law does not recognize me as an adult. All my life, I'm a minor. I'm considered a minor before the law. And we use the driving as a symbol of civil disobedience.
You should explain the guardianship laws. A woman is considered a minor her entire life. So you always have to have a guardian. At first, it's your father, but then that changes through your life?
I imagine having a car with a registration paper. And when you sell the car, the registration paper move to the new owner. This is exactly Saudi women. We have the guardianship, assigned legal guardian, male guardian. And this assigned male guardian changed through our life. If I'm single, it's my father. If I don't have a father, it could be my uncle or my brother. When I get married, it moves to my husband. Let's say I don't have a husband or a brother or a father. It can be my own adult son. My own adult son give me permission and the consent to get my papers or leave the country. Or even if I'm in jail, when I was in jail, I needed my guardian to sign the release papers. So even if I finish my sentence in jail, I'm not allowed to leave jail as a society woman without my assigned male guardian come to jail and sign the papers. And I know a lot of girls are still in jail because their family feel ashamed. They won't go and sign the papers of their release, even after they finish their sentence.
Well, in some ways, what you're describing is a culture in which women are always in jail in some way or another. I think you wrote in the book that, is a woman supposed to have her guardian's permission to leave the house?
Yes, the spoken permission. She has to ask the guardian his permission to leave the house.
So would you do that when you were married? Would you ask your husband if you could leave the house?
Yes, I had to.
What would happen if you left without his permission?
He would get angry.
I can see that the driving would become a symbol of being able to determine your own location, I guess, your own
drive your own,
movement.
Destiny. We call it drive your own destiny.
It wasn't always this way in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the country was relatively permissive until Wahhabism, this brand of much more fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, became the norm, which was back in the 70s, I think. And you're part of the whole generation of young people that were affected by that. How old were you when you were radicalized, you know, really adopted a much more fundamentalist interpretation?
I think I was 14 or 15. It was in my middle school.
Uh-huh.
When I was looking for identity and I wanted to please my religious teachers, who were the most popular in the school. And some of my generation were immune, but they were very few. And the most of us were prone to radicalization, which is following strict interpretation of the Islamic texts that was imposed on us in schools, in the street, in public places, everywhere.
And you actually became more fundamentalist than your family. I mean, you went home and confiscated your brother's music cassettes. And I don't know, what else did you do?
Yeah, I caused my brother to be kicked out of the house for one day for having a singer's picture in his wallet.
When you look back at that period of your life when you were a much more devout Islamic fundamentalist, are there things that you regret?
Oh my God, a lot. I think just giving hard time to my family. We couldn't even watch TV. I would just be policing them for not listening to music because it was haram. Being angry at dad for not going to the mosque to pray Fajr prayer, which is the dawn prayer. I regret burning my own drawings that I spent years and years and years working on in my sketchbooks. I didn't really have choice. I was thinking this is the right way to do it. I feel like I lost really beautiful times of my life, but it's not about really reminiscing and regretting the past more than what you do with today, that you never go back there, you never fall in that hole again.
And what about now? Because you've paid a pretty heavy price for driving that car. You wound up leaving Saudi Arabia and you had to leave your son behind. Do you ever feel guilty about the choices that you made?
I think he will understand, my son. He's a big boy. Sometimes we don't have the choice. There are things that choose us, and they're bigger than us. I don't think I regret, because if no one speaks up, if no one is willing to pay the price for speaking up, there's no hope. When I wrote the book, I was thinking, I'm going to give hope to women in my country. I don't want to bring them down. I want to bring them up. I want to say, listen, I'm here. I made it.
That's Manal Al-Sharif. She's the author of Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening.
Starting route to 66 Church Street.
Have you noticed that it's getting harder to get lost? I mean, no matter where you are, you're never more than a touch screen away from one of those frosty computer voices saying, turn left here.
Head north on North Park Street.
What if we forget how to get lost? Maybe we'll have to relearn. That's why Rebecca Solnit wrote an instruction manual, a field guide to getting lost.
There's this sort of literal getting lost, oh no, I don't know where I am, it's a problem, what do I do next? But even that poses interesting questions. You know, you don't know what's going to happen next, you don't know where you are. Is it an adventure? Have you extended beyond the bounds of your own safety, your own knowledge? Is there something to be discovered? Will you become somebody else when you find out where you are? And so navigating that danger and discovery, going beyond the sort of safe and familiar and contained, it's something that interests me a lot, coming to terms with a world in which we're not lost necessarily geographically, but maybe more metaphysically, more in terms of a world full of surprises, lost temporally. This book is written against the grain of the moment we're in, I think, which is very much about safety, familiarity, control, about having your cell phone and GPS and automatic garage door opener. Really contain your experience so that you don't find yourself beyond your own knowledge or beyond the familiar much. And I'm interested in what happens when you do get beyond. If you're really paying attention, I think, and really living your life, you turn out not to be who you thought you were. The person you're married to turns out to be somebody else, too. Your life opens up in ways you could have never planned for. The world itself changes in amazing ways.
Feel like getting lost? Rebecca Solnit. She's the author of A Field Guide to Getting Lost. And speaking of field guides, writer Lawrence Ross found an old guidebook recently that inspired him to take what he calls the blackest road trip ever. He drove 3,000 miles from L.A., where he lives, to Roanoke, Virginia. And along the way, he challenged himself to stop only at African-American-owned hotels, restaurants, and gas stations, and to use this 1957 field book as a guide.
I'm gonna buy my green cruise up and down the road.
Charles Monroe Kane was enchanted.
Well, first, what a cool thing to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of have this idea, wow, you know, I'm going to be traveling across the country anyway. So why not turn it into something a little bit special?
So one thing extraordinary you did, of course, was you did it based on a book. Of course, a book I've never heard of. What is this green book?
Originally, it was called the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it was done by a man named Victor Green, a New York City postal worker who saw that there was a need for a travel guide for African Americans during segregation. The whole idea was that African Americans couldn't just hit the road just like anyone else, right? Up until the 1964 Civil Rights Act, any public accommodation could say, no, we don't want African Americans to eat at our restaurant or sleep at our hotels. And so what the guide was designed to do was to tell African American travelers where they could actually stay, where they could actually eat, you know, where they could get gas. And it was a really helpful guide in order to expand the world for African Americans, because travel was something that was fraught with danger, particularly when you were going through the South, but not exclusively to the South.
Well, let's go. Let's go. Let's do it. Tell me, what was the first place you visited?
The very first place I went was Hooper's gas station over in Compton, California, which was to gas up, of course, but it's one of the only African-American gas stations in Los Angeles. And if you can imagine—
You mean now, right?
Now, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, now. Yeah, if you can imagine, you know, the car, you know, capital of the world only having one black-owned gas station, it's pretty incredible.
It's amazing. So you leave Los Angeles, and I understand on your map, you head to Arizona, right?
Right. I go to Phoenix, Arizona, and one of the addresses that caught my eye was the Louis Jordan home. Now, people who understand music and everything, they know Louis Jordan is one of the pioneers in jazz and hip-hop and R&B. And so I figured, oh, okay, this is a great thing. Maybe it's the same Louis Jordan. Maybe it's somebody else, right? So I go over there, and it's a brick building kind of in the desert. It was listed in the book as a tourist home. Listeners should think of an Airbnb, you know, of 1957. Basically, what you could do is you could go to a boarding home or a private home that someone owned and rent a room. because you wouldn't be able to get a hotel. So I knock on the door, and the guy comes out, and I'm just, you know, hey, tell him what I'm doing, and I'm just trying to figure out, okay, who lives here now? And he says, oh, well, this home doesn't belong to Louis Jordan anymore. This home belongs to the Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan. So I was like, wow. You know, you don't think, I think it was going to be like Mabel Jones. So it was incredible to find, and I found that, you know, that history and present day kind of mix in almost all of these homes.
I got to ask you a question. You're trying to go to only black establishments to spend your money. How'd it feel?
Oh, it was absolutely phenomenal. And yet you mentioned the fact that one of the things I was trying to do was to see how much money I could spend at black-owned businesses.
Right.
And the whole point of that is to understand that black economics has always been one of the pillars of African-American civil rights movement, being able to have a business and then using that business to help build up neighborhoods.
Sure.
And one of the things that was great was to see, in particular, all these young entrepreneurs, particularly young African-American women who were entrepreneurs who were taking risks. This one young woman decided to open up a vegan restaurant in the heart of South Dallas.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, that's a mighty long odds when you're basically competing against some of the most delicious fried chicken and soul food around in South Dallas. And you could see how people were tying it back to some heritage when it came back to, you know, African Americans pre going to urban areas, being farmers and being closer to the land. And it just was great to just see kind of the entrepreneurial spirit, the risk taking, and the pride that a lot of these business owners were taking. And so I felt really happy to spend my money there.
Wow, you sound so optimistic and enthusiastic about it. It reminds me of an interview we did once with Toni Morrison, you know, the great writer Toni Morrison. And she said, you know, it's not a popular view, but she's nostalgic for pre-segregation because the black barber and the black dentist and the black store were all patronized by other blacks and there was more community. And she said she misses that time.
There's always a yin-yang with African-American community. There's always a yin-yang because on the one hand, segregation forces you because you're declared second-class citizens by the state to be in the same neighborhood. So therefore, you have to patronize your own within those blocks, that neighborhood. But we always should remember the fact that that visceral feeling of community was imposed upon us based upon the idea that we were inferior and so therefore we did not deserve the rights of everyone else.
You know, it's funny. I'm picturing you going out and doing this and you're popping up and knocking on a door. You say you felt welcomed, but I'm wondering if you felt like you were at home when you come into these barbershops and these places and these restaurants and these buildings. Did you feel at home?
Yeah, you know, I had this one experience that I just loved. There was this one experience where I popped up around 3 o'clock in Monroe, Louisiana. I walked into a barbershop pool hall, and you see a, you know, about a dozen African-American men. You can tell that these are working men. These are, you know, men who are from 50 on up. Yeah, and these are the type of men, you know, with grizzled hands, with broken knuckles, you know, from having done a lifetime worth of work. And, you know, one of the things I always joke about is that being African-American, that was my passport in, but it didn't mean I gained the respect. You know, I wasn't from Monroe.
Right.
They had never met me before. And they looked at me. They couldn't instantly go through the Rolodex of relatives and say, hey, you know, that's so-and-so's nephew or so on and so forth. And I looked at that pool hall as being a sacred space. You know, I stayed there for 15 minutes. It's as long as I wanted to stay there because I figured after that, my time may be running a little long. But, you know, it's but that's those are type of the African-American community is a very welcoming community. A very, you know, we always joke is that we'll teach you, you know, you come up to my house, I'll tell you where everything is one time. Then after that, it's on you. You go and you get your stuff and you're family, you know. And by the time 15 minutes later, we'll have connections. We don't need Ancestry.com. We can make connections at some point in time of how we know each other and everything. We've never met in 50-something years. But that's kind of the warmth that you received. And I think that's life-affirming, particularly for African-Americans, because on a day-to-day basis, African-Americans deal with their regular, you know, normal lives, you know, just like everybody else. They go to work, they deal with their family and everything else like that. And then you deal with the social issues that come from the outside, the social issues intra-racial, the social issues that are interracial. And it's, a lot of times you don't really take the time, you know, you slow down and just enjoy what it means to be part of a community that's so warm and loving. And I think this trip was one of the – was something that I would encourage everyone to do.
You know, it's funny. I not that I keep track of every word you're saying while I'm interviewing you, but I did keep track of a word that you said twice, and you used the word sacred twice in this interview.
Right.
Like, what made this sacred?
Well, I think it is sacred because African Americans in this country have always, you know, yearned for the permanence of space, this idea that I have a stake in this place. And so when we actually create something, when someone, for example, in Jackson, Mississippi, there was a restaurant called Shepherd's Cafe, then it turned into called Stevens Cafe. And when I did the research, one of the things that I found was how many people talked about the ritual of going from church and heading over for a meal afterwards to go into Stevens Cafe. That's where you build your building blocks of who and what you are. Your sense of community, the sense of who you think are who are the people you think are important. And I think that's as important as walking into a church. I think that's just as important for a community as recognizing the humble person who may be waiting on you is just as royal as the mayor of the city, due to the fact that they're the person who cares for you. They're the people who recognize you growing up. That's what makes it sacred. You know, those are the things that, you know, it's the relationships that makes the space a sacred.
Writer Lawrence Ross talking about the road trip, which he calls the route trip, that he took across the U.S. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And now a fable from Sherman Alexie.
In July 1933, construction began on the Grand Coulee Dam. One of the largest concrete structures in the world, that dam submerged ancient villages and falls and eventually killed all of the wild salmon in the Upper Columbia and Spokane Rivers. Before the dam was finished, my mother once told me, I walked from one side of the Spokane River to the other on the backs of wild salmon. Hey, wait, I said. Big Mom said she did the same walk when she was a little girl. We both did it. You're lying, I said. It's not a lie, my mother said. Well, let's get it straight. Speaking in terms of history and physics, my mother absolutely did not make that walk across the river. And Big Mom certainly never made that walk either. But they weren't lying when they claimed to have made that walk. They were telling a story about how the Spokane River once was home to an epic number of wild salmon. If you insist that my mother and grandmother lied about making a footbridge of salmon, then it's a lie in service of scientific and spiritual truth. Scientifically and spiritually, the Grand Coulee Dam murdered my tribe's history, murdered my tribe's relationship with its deity, and murdered my tribe's relationship with its future. For us, the Grand Coulee Dam is an epic gravestone. What is it like to be a Spokane Indian without wild salmon? It is like being a Christian if Jesus had never rolled back the stone and risen from his tomb.
Writer Sherman Alexie travels the roads of history after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Thank you.
Some road trips can be measured not so much in miles as in psychic distance. Novelist Sherman Alexie grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in eastern Washington state, but he went to an all-white high school miles away. So for years, he was shuttling back and forth between two very different worlds, and that's really been the story of his life ever since. Now he's come out with a memoir about his family, and especially about the very complicated relationship he had with his mother, who recently died. He told Steve Paulson that his story is haunted by ghosts.
Well, in the studio where I'm recording right now, I'm looking at a sign in the studio, and it says, "There are ghosts." I mean, it's quite the magical coincidence. Once again, it's the contemporary and it's the ancient. Everywhere I go, I live with ghosts. And whether you think they're spiritual or whether you think they're real, I'm constantly aware of what is missing. You know, when your mother dies, everything becomes theological. I don't know if you knew that, but it does. And a friend of mine who's just as agnostic as I am said, "Sherman, you're like Paul on the road to Damascus, except with a lot more F words."
So you grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in eastern Washington state, and you had this incredibly rich history there. You also had to deal with a lot of the problems we often hear about regarding reservation life. I mean, extreme poverty, alcoholism, violence. When did you realize that you wanted or maybe needed to get off the reservation?
Well, I sort of knew it from the beginning. I was a very sick kid. When I was born, I was hydrocephalic, and I had two brain surgeries by the time I was 2 years old and had epileptic seizures and other minor, moderate, and serious health issues as a result. And like a lot of really sick kids, when you ask them what they want to grow up to be, they'll say pediatrician. They'll say doctor. I think it's a religious move. It's a way of assigning yourself a future, an afterlife from the sick life you have as a kid. And I was no different. But I knew from the first days of schooling that my tribal school at that point was really bad and was not going to give me the kind of education that would get me prepared for college and get me prepared for medicine. So I knew I was going to have to leave eventually, but to get up the courage took many years. And the inciting event was the first day of seventh grade. I opened up my math book and my mom's name was written in it, my mom's maiden name. It was a 30-year-old math book.
Wow.
And at that moment, I knew I was being crushed, not just because I was a Native American, not just because I grew on the reservation, but the fact that I was poor, the fact that I was rural, the fact that I was from a small town in a small place in a small state. So I was trapped by my zip code.
So you went to a public school with white kids not that far away, right?
22 miles away I started, and the world turned blonde overnight. You know, my joke is that I was the only Indian except for the mascot.
You would expect this to be really hard for you, being the only Indian kid there at that school. But then at least when you got to high school, you were a pretty popular young guy, weren't you?
Well, you know, I came in different, not just looking different with, you know, more melanin and black hair and with my reservation accent, which sounds like this.
which you can put on and off, I take it.
Yeah, like anybody who comes from an accented culture with a different language that influences the way you speak English, yes, I can drop in and out of it, and it's contagious too. So if I'm around other reservation Indians or I call home to my siblings, I'll quickly be talking like this, and my sons who don't have the accent at all because they're urban know who I'm talking to. yeah, it was incredibly difficult, but I was also attractive. I was new. I was book smart. I was a good athlete.
You were a basketball star, right?
I ended up being a basketball star, captain of the basketball team. I ended up being a good debater, which I didn't know I was going to be.
So it sounds like then you were shuttling back and forth between these two different worlds, 22 miles away. I mean, the all-white school, except for you, and the reservation.
And the thing is, what I realized is I was a first-generation immigrant into the United States. So my memoir and some of my other works are actually, in many ways, the work of a first-generation immigrant, even though I'm indigenous. So that it's an oxymoron, I know, the indigenous immigrant, but I've been oxymoronic my whole life with oxy in parentheses.
What would have happened, do you think, if you had stayed at your reservation school?
I imagine I would have become a teacher. You know, I think there's another life where I'm a high school English teacher and basketball coach. So I imagine I'd be at Wellpinit High School having them read books, and then when school was over, I'd be teaching them how to, you know, play the Warriors offense. I'd be hoping I'd find a little Steph Curry among all my little nieces, nephews, and cousins.
Yeah. Well, I want to give a sense of your family, because that's really what your memoir is about, especially your mother. And you write about an epic New Year's Eve party that your parents hosted back in the early 1970s. You were just a little kid at the time. What happened at that party?
Well, like a lot of alcoholic adults who are listening to this, and they'll certainly recognize the fact that I grew up in the party house, one of the party houses on our reservation, where people would gather on a regular basis to engage in heavy-duty alcoholic and drugs addiction. Sometimes there's violence, physical, emotional, spiritual, sexual. So what could be a very dangerous place, and it was scary no matter what. And there was a New Year's Eve party in the 70s, early 70s, where it became very dangerous. And in fact, my father ended up knocking himself out playing Nerf basketball, of all things. My mom punched another woman twice in the face. There was violence everywhere. And I hid in my room with my sisters. And eventually, my mother grabbed us about 3 or 4 in the morning and drove us to Chihuahua. And she often did this. Chihuahua was where she was born and spent a significant amount of her childhood, but it was a little white town. Then she took us back there that night, that early morning. And there, after getting a free breakfast from the sympathetic white waitress, my mother promised us, my brother and 2 sisters, that she would never drink again, that she would stop drinking. And, you know, she was a bipolar liar all of her life. She was a manipulative, mean, controlling, unpredictable. But she kept that promise. She never drank again. And that's the reason why we're all still alive, is the strength of her sobriety.
Hmm. Unlike your father, who did keep drinking, drank quite a lot.
My father kept drinking. He died in 2003 of alcohol-related kidney failure. He was only 62 when he died. It's amazing for me to think about that, 12 years older than I am now. Hmm. The astonishing difference between our lives, my father and I. Yeah. And I'm going to have the largest birthday party ever at age 63.
So your mother, I mean, you've already suggested, I mean, she was this really complicated person. I mean, ornery, could be kind of cruel at times. The way you write about this, it was sort of this open question whether she actually loved you. On the other hand, she was the family breadwinner. She was tough. She was the one who held the family together, and she was widely respected, even loved, by other people on the reservation. Am I getting this more or less right?
Yeah, she's a complicated person, you know. And as I've talked about the book and as I've heard people's reactions to my very complicated mother, I realize that I've written one of those biographies that white guys write about famous white guys that you see all the white guys in the airport reading, you know, with some white guy's face on the cover, and it has a name like Jefferson or Hamilton or JFK, you know, or the 99th volume of Lyndon Johnson. Why does Lyndon Johnson deserve 98 volumes? So I realize that I've written that book, that epic book about a complicated human being, a great human being who never had the chance, because of racism, sexism, classism, to achieve her greatness. But that great woman wasn't necessarily a great mother, wasn't even sometimes a good mother, and was often a bad mother.
Well, I mean, just to cite one example that sort of jumps out at you is, you know, that time when you were 10 years old, I guess you and your mom were having this screaming argument, and she threw a Pepsi can at your head and knocked you out.
Yeah, knocked me out. I was hydrocephalic. I'd had 2 brain surgeries. So a brain injury for a hydrocephalic kid, a concussion for a hydrocephalic kid is not the usual course. And when I woke up from getting knocked out, she was just quilting again. I don't know if she'd even move to help me. So I don't, you know, there's not a long history of well-adjusted children coming from great parents. So, you know, you can find these sort of stories in the memoirs and biographies of all sorts of children of powerful, unpredictable parents. And my mother was no different. I think of the books about James Dickey, the amazing poet, and how he didn't throw Pepsi cans, he threw beer cans.
Yeah. So here's my question. How much are you like your mother?
You know, it's funny. Right now on the social media Indian world, Native Americans are reacting very strongly to this book, positively and negatively. There's online fights between pro-me and anti-me's.
Must be weird for you to read all that.
I don't read it. I just hear about it. I'm not on social media. But it's interesting. So my sister, and my sisters are kind of a Greek chorus in the memoir. I consult them often for fact-checking, for emotional checking, just to hear their side of things. My sister, after apparently reading some of the social media about me in the native world, texted me and said, "So I hear you got some Indians mad at you again. You're just like Mom."
So do you take that as a compliment?
I take it as an accurate statement.
You live in Seattle now, right?
Yes. I've lived in Seattle for 22 years. Hmm. I'm very urban.
Do you go back to the Spokane Indian Reservation very often?
Not a whole bunch. Not to the res itself, but I see my siblings in Spokane. The res has ghosts for me, and it aggravates all sorts of trauma in me. So I go back to see my father and now my mother's tombstones, their shared gravesite, and hang around with my siblings a bit, but then I get out. I don't stay the night.
Too many bad memories or too painful?
Too many bad memories. I'm guaranteed of nightmares if I stay the night.
I'd love to end with another reading of yours, if you'd be up for that. I was thinking your poem, Tribal Ties.
I'll do that one.
Okay.
Chapter 81, Tribal Ties. Please remember, as you read my brutal poems about rape and murder and assault and dangerous loneliness ripped from the earth like uranium, please remember, as you read these poems about my dead mother and my dead father and all of my childhood pandemonium, please remember, as I weep inside my verse, that nearly every Indian kid I knew had it worse.
Sherman Alexie. His memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. He talked with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Raymond Tungekar and Doug Gordon produced this hour. They had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Karen McKechnie. Joe Hartke is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.